Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, September the 11th, 1995. In the Creekside Room this morning, our speaker is Jerry Pedersen. His subject, forgiveness, our most unused resource. Let's listen in.
My name is Jerry Pedersen, and we're going to have a course, sessions on forgiveness. I'm calling this first one our most unused resource. 2 years ago, I came up here, and my passion then was I did a thing for 1 week on radical Christianity, and that was my passion. I had written a text and was trying to get it published. Publishers didn't accept it, but then I did another one, and then, the second one was on forgiveness, that's right. But I was motivated to do it because of my own experiences within the last several years before that. And I had come to the conclusion that forgiveness is not something practiced very much, even by Christian people. And so I'm not exactly the expert in this. I am not a professor who's dealt with this in colleges. I'm not a psychologist, all that. I'm simply a person that knows how crucial this is if people are to live effectively. If you're interested at all, this is the book I'm suggesting by Lewis B. Smeeds. I think that's how you pronounce it. Forgive, Forget. And it's simple. They've got a bunch of them in the bookstore. And even if you're not going to be in all of these sessions, I recommend this. This is very down-to-earth, something that you could really benefit by. And should you be interested in putting some group together in your own congregation or elsewhere, now they have a study guide that goes with this. And I didn't know this existed. It's only been recently published. And I discovered it after I got up here in the bookstore. And had I realized they had such a thing, we would have organized this according to this. But I'm not doing that. But if you're at all interested, you might want to pick this up too. And I think it would make an excellent program in a congregation. It does say you've got to emphasize, of course, that you have continuity, that people commit to the whole process. They suggest six sessions, but you can change it. But I've learned at Holden, there is no consistency, because tomorrow you're going to want to go to something else, and then you're going to want to go hiking. But this is the text as I would suggest it. For myself, I'm a Lutheran pastor. I spent about half of my ministry on university campuses, one at Portland State College, and while I was there, it became Portland State University back in the 60s. I went to East Africa, Tanzania, for 3 years at a university college and organized their so-called chaplaincy or campus ministry program at the only university in Tanzania. And then spent 6 years at San Francisco State University, which is an experience in itself. It's like, I guess there are many other campuses like it. But in the late 60s, it was a place that was exciting to be at. I went there deliberately, chose that over a number of other places, because of all the exciting things that were going on. They were reaching out to minority students, trying to bring them into the educational process, black students especially, but Latinos and others, and trying to bring the faculty to have a few of these. Had special programs of entrance and study. They had an experimental college that was trying to do experimental things in the educational process. It was so great that's where I wanted to go. I no sooner got there than a very great governor of California by the name of Ronald Reagan started cutting funds for education, and there was crises in this, and it ended up, we had a long student strike and all kinds of happy things. Some of you have heard of S.I. Hayakawa. He was put in as the president of the university in the midst of my stay there, and he was not very happy with me. I was arrested, and he tried to get me removed from my position. The church stood behind me. And then I went to a parish in Southern California. Mount of Olives Lutheran Church was there 19 years. And I decided to retire here about a little over 3 years ago. I hit 67 then, and I said, hey, I think I've had it. Celebrated my 70th here 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, and enjoying life.
Don't look a day over 52.
Whoa.
What?
You don't look a day over 52.
Thank you. Say it loud. I'll tape it and let my wife see it. When I came up here 2 years ago, they had asked me to go to a small congregation that had had a bad experience, congregation and pastor. And I really had asked not to accept any positions like that, but I went there because they needed a healing process. And it was kind of neat because I was committed to come up here to Holden, so I knew I could only do it for 4 months, and I said, that's it, then I'm through. My task was to see if I couldn't initiate a healing process in a congregation. And I spent considerable effort with the small congregation that it was, and somewhat with the pastor. My experience was not very encouraging. I found that people are find it very difficult to forget the past, or if not to forget it, at least to move on from it and heal the relationships. And of course, in the process, no matter who has to be forgiven, my emphasis in this will be, forget about the other person. We need to forgive, if for nothing else, for our own sake, our own health. Because the lack of forgiveness just destroys people. It ties them into knots. And I'm going to read a letter. I don't know if this is the wise way to begin. But after I spent 1 month in the congregation's life, and I found that we were getting almost nowhere. We had 10 or 12 families that had been very active, including the president of the church council and several council members and other leaders, who during the month that I was there, the first month, had never showed up at a worship service. And I had gone to visit a number of them, and I found just I was up against a wall. And then the people in the congregation that were there, and there were probably 50, 60, 70 people, usually there in a Sunday morning, in talking to them, I found closed doors. And so I tried an experiment. I wrote a letter personally addressed to each member in the congregation, including those that had not been present. And I had discussed this with a number of people. I'm going to read the letter. In my 42 years as a pastor, I've discovered that one of the hardest things to teach or to learn is forgiving and being forgiven. It's easier to love, to give, to sacrifice, to witness, maybe even to die. But to forgive, that's very difficult. I'm writing this letter to a dozen families, each of whom have been active, faithful people at Christ Lutheran Church in the past. However, since I've been asked to be the interim pastor here, they have not been active in the congregation, unless it has been by silent prayers of concern. I was trying to say, I'm not criticizing anybody. I'm just, and perhaps you have, you know, really been doing the work of what Christian life is all about. But the fact is, you haven't been participating in the congregation. I went on. I'm also writing this letter to all families who have been active and faithful people at Christ Lutheran Church and have been active in the congregation since I've been asked to be the interim pastor. In other words, it is for each person personally, and it's for every person of the congregation. When I was requested by the bishop and the church council to serve as an interim pastor here, it was with the specific charge to seek healing and reconciliation of the entire congregation, if possible, but at least for each individual person who had come through difficult times, too often felt hurt, wounded, frustrated, maybe even angry. I've tried to do that as best I can with the former pastor and his family, and with each member wherever possible, and with the congregation as a whole. In every case, I've tried to help people keep their eyes on Christ and not on one another. That's how we get into trouble. I've tried to share the joy of being a follower of Christ, recognizing the good in each person and seeking to elicit the best in each one of them. And I believe much has been accomplished. Actually, I really didn't believe that. We hadn't accomplished very much, but I tried to be very positive and optimistic. And in every case, I've also urged people to forgive those who have hurt you. To any who have been unduly critical of the former pastor, I've urged writing him or letting him know that they are sorry if they've hurt him in any way. Ask his forgiveness and let him know their prayers go with him. Likewise, I've urged the same action for anyone who has hurt any other person. To people now worshiping, I've urged not only their prayers for those not at worship, but to extend a warm, "we miss you and truly hope for your presence," but also that they seek to forgive those who have hurt them, ask forgiveness from any they may have hurt. And to people not now worshiping, I've urged their prayers for the congregation, encouraged both their return, and that they seek to forgive those who have hurt them and ask forgiveness from any that they have hurt. However, I know forgiveness is difficult, and little has occurred on a verbal basis, although I know much has been given silently and in people's heart. Most people have simply avoided this crucial step in the Christian life. Some have been active in congregational life, but avoided the liberating and life-giving gift that comes from making a deliberate choice to release the person who has wounded them from the sentence of their judgment, however justified that judgment may be. Let me read that again. Some have been active in the congregation's life, but they've avoided the liberating, life-giving gift that comes from making a deliberate choice to release the person who has wounded them from the sentence of judgment, however justified the judgment may be. That's a theme that we're going to be talking about quite a bit. The liberation, the freedom, the empowerment that comes when you've got that monkey off your back of holding a grudge or being revengeful or angry or whatever. Others have tried to run away from congregational life and thereby avoid making the same deliberate choice to release others from their judgment, thereby missing the act of forgiving, which liberates the one who forgives. I know this is difficult. I've had to struggle with this in my own life. But there is no shortcut to the full blessedness that comes in the healed and reconciled life. As a pastor, I have no alternative but to do the most responsible job possible. The easy thing for me would be to simply avoid this most difficult task, pretend I had done my best, and walk away. But for 42 years, I've preached and practiced the gospel, the best I've known how. And this has been a joy, sharing grace, sharing good news, sharing the healing power of God is such a rich blessing, and I wanted to share it with you. How can I do this? I've asked that and tried to find a way. The following 2 weeks, I would like to share this fullest of Christ's gifts to us, that is, as Luther says in the Catechism, where there is forgiveness, there is life and salvation. By offering you and all others of Christ Lutheran Church the following. At 9 o'clock, I'll lead worship around the theme of forgiveness. At 10:15, I'll lead an exploration of the Bible and other spiritual resources so as to help each of us learn how and why and when to forgive and to accept forgiveness. If you prefer not to worship at 9, I hope and pray you will, please come at 10:15 in our searching time. Its purpose is not a, quote, head trip. Its purpose is to help each person, each hurting, frustrated, confused, or angry person to experience afresh God's grace and to be liberated inwardly from the burden of not having forgiven others or accepting forgiveness for oneself. It is my responsibility as a pastor to offer this gift to you. But even more, it's my privilege and joy to share Christ in this way, to witness to the power of God's love available to us when we discover that we are forgiven and that we can forgive. Christ has warmed my heart, and I want that for each of you. I want a warmed heart, a smiling face, a healed body and soul, a reconciled fellowship and friendship among all of God's people. Prayerfully, Dr. Pedersen. So, this is the letter I wrote to the congregation. I don't think I'd ever done anything quite like this before. And I did make some phone calls to some people to urge them to try to be present. Actually, it was a very rewarding 2 weeks that followed. Each sermon dealt with forgiveness in some sense, but then afterwards we had this hour together that usually became an hour and a half or more, in which we looked at the whole topic of forgiveness. And after some initial presentations, asked some their participation. I learned some things. I learned that forgiveness is not an easy thing for people. Wow, it is tough. And a lot of people at the top of their heads can say a lot of good things. They can quote you Bible verses. They can do all kinds of things telling you about forgiveness. But it doesn't permeate down into their own life experience. And some of the sharpest people in the congregation, they knew the head thing, but they didn't know the experiential thing. I learned that it takes time. I learned that forgiveness is a process. It doesn't get accomplished all at once. It has a lot of steps to it. It may come to sort of a climactic experience for people. For most people, it's stepping out and then kind of something saturates into their experience, stepping out again and extending it a little further, and it may take years. It may take a lifetime. And I think most people only get a little bit along the way. They don't ever fully get all the way. It takes time. Since that was 2.5 years ago, and I've kept in touch with a pastor that was called there, a woman who had just finished her studies and been ordained, and she said most of them still haven't really gotten very far along. I talked to the pastor that a lot of it had centered in relationships between the pastor and the people. I discovered, though, that as a congregation, it had its roots way, way, way back. I found the pastor had about as much difficulty as most of the people did. And excellent pastor, excellent leader, but he really couldn't deal with what forgiveness was about. I found that most people were much better at describing I found that most of them had a much greater readiness to forgive. They had more of a readiness to be a receiver of forgiveness. Because, of course, those people had hurt me. Or that person had hurt me. And so they were quite ready to talk about how others should be forgiving. It's much more difficult to talk for many to talk about I need to forgive, because people know their own hurts more than they know how they've hurt another. Of course, almost always it's a two-sided thing. It's a mutual thing. It's not a one-way street at all. But that's my experience that led me to this situation. Most of us need to learn how to act in life instead of react in life. It's very easy to just get into the habit of reacting to whatever confronts us. Then we react. And of course, until you're ready to take the initiative to act regardless of what has been done to you, you can't get very far in the whole forgiving or being forgiven process. And I'm convinced eventually, if somebody's hurt you and all, whether they're ready, you know, whether they repent and change has nothing to do with it. Yes, it has a lot to do with it. But that's not the key. The key is in yourself. Are you ready to take the initiative to learn how to begin the healing process? Finally, even to end the healing process. There may not ever come reconciliation with whoever, whatever it is, but that needn't tie up the person if they're ready to rise above that. Last week I did a course in nonviolence, and we looked at the teaching in the Sermon on the Mount when Jesus says, "Do not resist evil." And we looked a little bit at what does that, you know, what does that mean? And most people take it to mean, well, you're just to be submissive. You know, there's either you initiate using violence against somebody, or you're just submissive to it and let them run all over you. But I tried to promote the idea, and I think it's the correct understanding. Jesus was neither submissive, passive in regard to evil, nor was he, you know, ready to attack it viciously, but rather he had a third way. And that is, and the statement, I believe, really means, do not react to violence against you by countering it with a violence of your own, but rather take the initiative to find an alternative way to deal with evil that's done to you. Well, surely this applies here, that to react is the most natural thing in the world. If somebody hurts you, hurt them back, or at least don't forgive them because they don't deserve to. They were guilty. They were wrong. I mean, that's the natural thing to do. And, of course, the gospel comes along and says, hey, there's an alternative to that. It's the way of Jesus, I believe, but it's the key as we deal with forgiveness and the lack of it. Let me tell you about one more experience of my life. I was a young pastor, just gotten ordained, you know. And I ran into Mrs. Dietrich. Mrs. Dietrich was, if there was ever a bitch, she was it. For 1 year, she was miserable. She just caused all kind of frustration for me. Every time I turned around, she was saying something. She was gossipy. She was reporting bad things. She was making up things. She never had a kind word. She was terrible. I mean, she was really terrible. And it was just bugging me. And it was getting in my way to function. And finally, I had to make a decision. Well, I had to make a decision. Either I could kill her, or I could kick her out of the congregation, or I could tell her off, or, you know, I could do something. Or I had to stop reacting to Mrs. Dietrich and figure out, what can I do in this relationship? And I made a decision. I'm going to try to make her my dearest friend. I'm going to talk about Mrs. Dietrich as though she is just a beautiful person, just a lovely person. I tried to recognize gifts that she had. And she had a lot of gifts. She was an organizer. Of course, she'd always organized gossipy things, destructive things in the past. But I went to her and I asked her help time and again. Would she help me deal with a problem? Help me with somebody in the congregation? Help me with some situation? I tried to report, you know, in talking to others, positive things about Mrs. Dietrich, and people to look at me and say, you talking about Irma? Mrs. Dietrich? Yeah. Yeah, this is what she did. Do you know, almost overnight, she was a changed person. No. She was only half of a bitch. I mean, she was radically changed. She would actually smile once in a while. She still kept a lot of the old stuff. But then I started to learn about her. She had come from a congregation in Los Angeles That was for the what they called the deaf and the dumb. She had a good part of her family were either deaf or they couldn't speak. She had been terribly abused as a child. From a very poor family. She married a man who probably weighed about half as much as her. She totally dominated this guy, but he was disfigured in the face. He couldn't talk very well. He was able to earn a very poor living for the family. And the more I learned, I realized she had come out of all kind of impossible circumstances. And I said, hey, gosh, I came from a family that was, you know, all-American family. They were active in the church. They, you know, my dad, during the Depression, made $19 a week, but he had a job. And, you know, my own circumstances were all positive towards a healthy life. Hers had all been negative. And I discovered that as long as I reacted to Ms. Dietrich, she was what was the most natural thing in the world for her. The moment I decided I'm going to change my attitude towards her, I'm going to see possibilities instead of, you know, all the negatives, I'm going to treat her as much as I can, I'm going to speak well of her and all, it helped her to begin changing. And she actually was, in many ways, a positive influence in the congregation, as well as this negative one. And it was one of those experiences that was life-changing for me in learning how to deal and relate to people. I learned how to start acting instead of reacting. And I think that's key when it comes to understanding forgiveness. I'm going to read something from Forgive and Forget. I did look at the Leader's Guide, and it was one of the suggestions for this first session that I thought made a lot of sense. So I'm going to read this. It's The Magic Eyes, a little fable. And it's 2 pages long, but I think you'll find it interesting. In the village of Faken in the innermost Friesland, there lived a long, thin baker named Fulk, a righteous man with a long, thin chin and a long, thin nose. Fulk was so upright that he seemed to spray righteousness from his thin lips over everyone who came near him. So the people of Faken preferred to stay away from him. Fulk's wife, Hilda, was short and round, her arms were round, her bosom was round, her rump was round. Hilda did not keep people at bay with righteousness. Her soft roundness seemed to invite them instead to come close to her in order to share the warm cheer in her open heart. Hilda respected her righteous husband and loved him too, as much as he allowed her. But her heart ached for something more from him than his worthy righteousness. And there in the bed of her need lay the seed of sadness. One morning, having worked since dawn to knead his dough for the ovens as a baker, Fulk came home and found a stranger in his bedroom lying on Hilda's round bosom. Hilda's adultery soon became the talk of the town and the scandal of the Faken congregation. Everyone assumed Fulk would cast Hilda out of his house, so righteous was he. But he surprised everybody by keeping Hilda as his wife, saying he forgave her as the good book said he should. In his heart of hearts, however, Folk could not forgive Hilda for bringing shame to his name. Whenever he thought about her, his feelings toward her were angry and hard. He despised her as if she were a common whore. When it came right down to it, he hated her for betraying him after he had been so good and so faithful a husband to her. He only pretended to forgive Hilda so that he could punish her with his righteous mercy. But folks' fakery did not set well in heaven. So each time that folk would feel his secret hate toward Hilda, an angel came down to him and dropped a small pebble, hardly the size of a shirt button, into folk's heart. Each time a pebble dropped, folk would feel a stab of pain, like the pain he felt the moment he came on Hilda feeding her hungry heart from a stranger's larder. And thus he hated her more. His hate brought him pain, and his pain made him hate more. But the pebbles multiplied, and folk's heart grew very heavy with the weight of them, so heavy that the top half of his body bent forward so far he had to strain his neck upward in order to see straight ahead. Weary with hurt, folk began to wish he were dead. Now the angel who dropped the pebbles into his heart came to folk one night and told him how he could be healed of his hurt. There was one remedy, the angel said. By the way, it says, he said, and I always think angels, she. How do you think?
I always think of a lady angel.
He calls the angel he. I really don't know much about angels.
That's right.
There was one remedy, he said, only one for the hurt of a wounded heart. Folk would need the miracle of the magic eyes. He would need these eyes that could look back at the beginning of his hurt and see his Hilda, not as a wife who betrayed him, but as a weak woman who needed him. Only a new way of looking at things through the magic eyes could heal the hurt flowing from the wounds of yesterday. Folk protested. Nothing can change the past, he said. Hilda is guilty, a fact that not even an angel can change. Yes, poor hurting man, you are right, said the angel. You cannot change the past. You can only heal the hurt that comes to you from the past. And you can heal it only with a vision of the magic eyes. And how can I get your magic eyes? Pouted Falk. Only ask, desiring as you ask, and they will be given you. And each time you see Hilda through your new eyes, one pebble will be lifted from your aching heart. Folk could not ask at once, for he had grown to love his hatred. You know people who love their hatred? And each time you see Hilda through your new eyes, folk could not ask at once, for he had grown to love his hatred. But the pain of his heart finally drove him to want and to ask for the magic eyes that the angel had promised. And so he asked, and the angel gave. Soon Hilda began to change in front of folk's eyes, wonderfully and mysteriously. He began to see her as a needy woman who loved him, instead of a wicked woman who betrayed him. The angel kept his promise. He lifted the pebbles from folk's heart one by one, though it took a long time to take them all away. Folk gradually felt his heart grow lighter. He began to walk straighter again, and somehow his nose and his chin seemed less thin and sharp than before. He invited Hilda to come into his heart again, And she came, and together they began again a journey into their second season of humble joy. It's pretty neat. I'm supposed to ask you a question. In the fable of the Magic Eyes, folk who had been betrayed said, "Nothing can change the past." What was the angel's response? How does it relate to the study on forgiveness? Anybody remember what the angel's response was?
You can't change the past, but you can deal with the hurt that you gained from the past. So if you deal with the hurt towards the future and have a bright future.
You don't even have to come to the rest of class. You get an A+ in this course. Yes, the angel said, you cannot change the past. You can only heal the hurt that comes to you from the past. Forgiveness is the process by which we heal ourselves of the pain of remembered hurt, which can destroy us with its bitterness. Anybody like to react to that fable? Does it suggest anything to you? Yes.
Why do people grow to love their hate? I mean, is it just a question of it's familiar, it's safe, it's known to them, anything different to be uncomfortable and frightening?
Why do people?
I guess come to love them? I think a lot of times it gives people a lot of power. Mm. They feel empowered by having hate because it's a strong.
I think that's
righteousness.
I guess when I was listening to that, I was thinking of the wife and how his righteousness. Where I see a lot of people, and I guess I've seen it in the church more than I've seen it outside the church. Always sort of the self-righteous, and so I guess the way he was, I really don't think his wife was, you know, she was certainly not getting any of her needs met, and so she then decided to go someplace else to get those needs, and so then she is this bad person, but then he's so self-righteous, he's fine. And I have a problem with that. I mean, I'm not saying that what, you know, her choice was right, but living with a person like that must be pretty lonely and destructive. And there, again, I heard, or when I was listening to it, I was thinking how powerful he felt that he was, but really in reality, he was pretty powerless. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of times some of this stuff gets into, you know, power. Mm-hmm. I guess that's how I see it sometimes. And I was thinking about in 1984, I'm the village nurse here, but I was living in Minnesota, and we had a nurses' strike. And so we had, you know, you had to make a decision to stand together in solidarity, or some people crossed over. And now, well, it's been a couple years now since I've worked with the hospital, there are still people who are angry and carrying this. I mean, it was that many years ago. And it seems to me, too, then that's also a power thing with this anger and this kind of feeling towards other people. I mean, I felt really saddened that some people didn't stick together, you know, that we didn't stick together, but I've, you know, let that go, and they had their own reasons, you know, so you...
Couldn't it also be a lack of power?
Let me ask you, if you talk, will you talk up, because I'll not get all this on tape, otherwise tapes have a lull in them.
Okay, well, my thought is that you can also turn it on its side and say that it's also a sense of perceived lack of power, the feeling that you have been injured, the feeling that you have no way of balancing that injury, the feeling that there's nothing that can be done. It's a kind of helplessness. Mm-hmm. And it's an anger. I think some of it is a reluctance to admit that something has been done to you that cannot be balanced. that sometimes things happen and you cannot balance the scales. And rather than admit that, you hold that anger, you love the anger, you hold it to you, because the alternative is to admit that something was done to you, that you are helpless to balance, that you cannot gain revenge, recompense, you can't balance the scales. And I think a lot of that comes from a feeling of helplessness, a sense of being toyed with by forces uncaring, more powerful than yourself.
It can be a defense mechanism, I think. You recognize that your original position wasn't a very strong position or a very good one, and it's hard to admit that. And now this explosion of some kind has taken place. You feel that you have been wronged, and you defend your whole approach to life by blaming it onto that other person instead of accepting a share of the blame yourself.
See, this may be a little early on in the process, but this strikes me as a fairly minor thing to forgive, not perhaps to the husband, but I'm just wondering about the things that are very... It seems to me that some things do move into the realm of being almost impossible to forgive. How does an inmate of Auschwitz forgive the guards who tortured and beat and starved him? I mean, this is the thing that I wonder about. I mean, can you let go of that? I mean, is it forgiveness or is it letting go that we call forgiveness? But I don't know that you can actually, you know, this may be a battering about of semantic definitions, but I do wonder if there are some things that are virtually impossible, if not impossible, to forgive. And this may not be the time in the process to talk about it, but it seems to me that here you have a husband and a wife where there is some feeling between each other. And yes, she has betrayed him in his eyes, but she has not done anything to him directly. It is more his sense of their relationship. And I'm thinking of things that are much tougher to forgive. Child abuse.
She's betrayed him, so I mean that's directly affecting him.
Yeah, it is, and in his eyes, I'm saying that, but I'm just saying it on just an absolute level. Mm-hmm. That some things, you know, this sort of a subject that's weighing on me at the moment, because I've been doing some work on teen suicides, mm-hmm. and what drives young people to kill themselves, and the stories, you know, the horrific stories of parents who abuse their children. I mean, in ways that seem out of a Stephen King novel. And how do you?
Well, I hope we're talking a good deal more about that. This question: why do people continue a destructive, you know, way of living? Loving their hatred.
In the fable, he has community support. However, he is expected to have left his wife, and he, in his righteousness, doesn't do that. And so the community looks at him as even being more righteous in his unforgiving state.
But according to the fable, they didn't get near him because they couldn't stand that righteousness. But perhaps they did. He is the righteous man in the community. Yeah. Well, it's why people continue destructive behavior. To an outsider, it can seem very clear and plain. But if you built your whole system, a security system, it's a way you learn how to function. And people get hooked into it, a pattern of destructive behavior. But, you know, why do nations continue to war? I get interested. People say, well, the trouble with pacifism or nonviolence is it doesn't work. And I say, well, wait a minute, are you saying violence works? Mm-hmm. Are you saying that wars work? Are you saying that training up a child with a destructive, violent pattern works? It doesn't produce a healthy child. It produces a twisted child who's you know, lost confidence, lost esteem, that is a fractured child as they grow. So that, but people seem to continue to love their pain, love their hurt.
Well, I think too, it takes a lot of work to move out of self-destructive behavior. It's comfortable. I mean, this is what you've learned. You haven't really learned really good coping skills or how to deal with things. And so to move out of that, it's scary. Mm-hmm. And to be more healthy, to be more loving, it's risky. And so if you keep this anger and this other kind of behavior, it gives you, I think it does give you a lot of power and control. Mm-hmm. It's pretty scary to give that up and to let go and to be more accepting and so forth.
Kind of like a fear of the unknown. A lot of people fear what they don't know. And if you never try to forgive or been caring, that, you know.
If you've tried it a few times and you got clobbered, you got struck down, you weren't accepted, it's easier to hold back from it.
Okay. I've tried it. I've been clobbered, like you just said.
Yeah.
But to me, there is more power in, I mean, it's a wonderful gift to give yourself, to let yourself off the hook. You know, you no longer give these things power over you. And I don't know if that is just a different kind of power and a different kind of power addiction, but to me, to take that option, it's almost like a selfish option. Hey, I have the option of not letting these things have power over my life, have this destructive influence in my heart and in my soul. So why don't people want to do it?
The other thing that I've seen as a nurse, and I've read a lot about it, is that with this anger, resentment, not forgiving, and then the people, so many people are in depression, and that is a huge, I mean, I have seen a lot of it even here at Fulda. And if we continue to carry this hate and resentment and so forth, it just will cause this depression, and so you get into this sort of self-pity into oneself, and you then can't move out. And so I think that is so important to be able to forgive, but then forget, and then let it go, and move on with one's life.
We're going to deal with forgetting another time. Is forgiving, does it imply forgetting or something? But some years ago, I watched as a 13-year-old boy was returning to the custody of his parents. It was a disturbing transaction. After the father mumbled a few words to the presiding judge, the parents and the son passed through the courthouse corridors, down the many stairways, and across several streets to their car for the ride home. During the course of the long walk, not a word was spoken, nor was there an embrace or even a handshake. These hurt and hurting people even avoided eye contact with each other. When they got to the house, the father announced, "Things will be different from now on." And then he turned and left to spend his day elsewhere. The mother tidily hung her coat in the hall closet, went to the kitchen where she kept busy for the rest of the afternoon. The son stretched out on a sofa. Two younger sisters came by and gawked. He pulled a throw cushion over his face and groaned. Technically, a reconciliation had occurred. The son and his parents were reunited, brought together. But this was about as far from a lasting reconciliation as one could possibly imagine. I was sent to the court that morning by the private school the son had been attending when he ran away from home 3 months before, where he had run away from home 3 months before. The school promised readmission, and I was there to confirm that message. He ran away again 2 weeks later. "We did everything we could for him," the mother told him. Or told me. "We even brought him a new..."
He wants you to talk in the microphone.
What is he saying?
Talking to the mic.
Well, technology, you get dependent on it, and I... I went to the court that morning by the private school the son had been attending when he ran away from home 3 months before. The school promised readmission. I was there to confirm that message. He ran away again 2 weeks later. We did everything we could for him, the mother told me. We even bought him a new stereo the day he left. What went wrong? Many things, I suppose. One of those things is the subject of this book. This book is Learning to Forgive. It's in the library. Forgiveness is part of a process that begins with a hurt and ends as its final and long-range goal with the event of reconciliation. To reconcile means to bring together that which belongs together, but which is apart. It works only when we pause to forgive, only when we become aware of the depths of the offense against us, so that we can forgive with all our wits about us and ensure an enduring peace. Most of the time, we bypass forgiveness. Most of the time, like parents in this story, we race with lightning speed from our hurt to reconciliation without taking a look at what must be forgiven before lasting healing can take place. The fact of the matter is we've been programmed since childhood not to nurse our wounds, to keep a stiff upper lip, to pretend that we are unaffected by other people's cruelty, deliberate or accidental. In other words, we are programmed to bypass forgiveness. This etiquette is reinforced ritually by a series of gestures that allow us to bypass surgery on our hurts and emotions. We can probably all remember a parent somewhere directing little children to kiss and make up, or a mediator either coaching two friends to shake hands or encouraging estranged adults to hurry and get together again. The premium has been on speed. The quicker we move from our grief, the better. Better still, not to even notice it at all, we are told. I must admit, I have been very fortunate in life. I was surrounded by a strong family from childhood, and I believe not registering from hurts has come rather easy for me. I didn't have a lot of hurts thrust on me. And so what I know many other people take to be some kind of a hurting situation, somebody caused me pain, somebody judged me, I didn't interpret it that way. And so I've been fortunate. I really feel that I have. And this topic of forgiveness is not something that I came to easily, because I've never really felt the need to be forgiving that much, because people didn't hurt me that much. Or if people screwed up, I didn't need to forgive them. They just made a stupid act, you know. It didn't register on me. And I find I'm fortunate and I'm not fortunate. I'm often not sensitive enough to what hurts other people. And this is my problem. People in congregation, somebody will say, well, do you know what this person did? And they'll repeat what took place, and I'll think, that's bothering you? That happens to me all the time. But it does bother them. And my tendency is to kind of quickly just, you know, move beyond it. Well, smile and just go and don't let it bother you. Go and continue your friendship with a person. I've avoided forgiveness, asking, giving often, and I need to work on that. And I find that often people who have been deeply hurt themselves are much more sensitive and sometimes more sensitive and helpful to others because they've had to battle this thing through themselves so much. One of the things we'll talk about a little later is the place of repentance and forgiveness.